according to Rabbah, his davening is a davening. He doesn't have to repeat it, in other words. But Rabbah disagrees. He says that this is Zevach Rishoyim, right? And as the interpretation is, Elo Amar Rabbah, but rather Rabbah said, Hovil Vechoto, inasmuch as he has sinned, because of the fact that, you know, he wasn't careful as to where he was standing to say Shemin Esrei. So Afal Pisha is Palel, even though he has prayed. He said the Shemin Esrei, nevertheless, Tfiloso Tueva. Okay? He can't do, you know, that his prayer is Tueva. So now the question is, so what does Rava want of him? Besides the fact that, of course, he wants him, you know, to
be more careful.
To be more careful. So this is why, if you take a look to the right, you see there's a star. You see it? Yeah. All right, now you see on the right over there, you see that Nun Aleph.
Nun Aleph, yeah.
Nun Aleph. Nun Aleph means Nusach Acher, another version of the text of the Talmud. Of course, we had different versions of the text. So Nusach Acher says, Mai Takanto. So in other words, this is Rava who's suggesting, what Takana, in other words, how can he make up for the fact that he has sinned? Understand? So the answer is Lahadev Elitzli. In other words, let him repeat the Shemin Esrei
in
a clean place. Okay?
Where is this? I see the Nun Aleph.
Right, Nun Aleph, it says. And then what does it say? It says, Maita Kanto.
Okay, what do I say? Maita Kanto.
Right,
okay.
Maita Kanto. Well, how should he, you know, repair this problem? How can he fix it up? So the answer is Lahadev Elitzli. Let him again. Davin Shemin Esrei. All right, we continue. Tana Rabbanan, another baraisa. Our rabbis taught us, Hoyoyme Bitvila. What happened if a man was staying Shemin Esrei, Umayim Shosim al Birkov, and suddenly he cannot control his urination? It may be, you know, that he's been suppressing it. Or it may be, you know, as unfortunately many of us are familiar with the fact that when you get a prostate problem, that at times it's not that easy, you know, to hold in the urine. You can't contain it that easily.
Some people don't have control.
Right. So what happens if you were staying Shemin Esrei and, you know, here when it says mayim, you know, water, it doesn't really mean water. What it means is
urine
began, you know, flowing al birkov, or shosasin doesn't necessarily mean to flow, but it means, you know, it's splattered.
Dribbled.
Yeah, dribbled or splattered. This is really the meaning of the word shosasin.
Well, it's al birkov.
Yeah. Al birkov on his knees.
On his knees.
Right. In other words, the water came, you know, the sunrise came down. Okay? So, poisek. Then in that case, he has to stop what he is saying. At sheyiful hamayim, until, you know, the urination has stopped, the chozer mispalel, and then he again says Shemin Esrei. So the question is, the heichan chozer, where should he return to? Because the word chozer means literally return. So the question is, what does he return to in order to say Shemin Esrei? So, Rav Chista and Rav Hamnuna, there was a disagreement concerning this between Rav Chista and Rav Hamnuna. Chad Omar Chozer LaRosh. One was of the opinion that you have to go back to the beginning of the Shemin Esrei and start, you know, and say the whole thing over again. The Chad Omar, but the other one said LeMokim Sheposach. He continues from the place. He goes back and continues from the place where he interrupted, right, where he stopped. So the Gemara wants to know, Lema Behor Kamiflegei, are we to say then that the difference of opinion, you know, what was the machlokes? It was that Mar Sovar im Shoho Kedei Ligmor Eskulo, that one authority said that if he stopped, the amount of time it would take to finish a complete Shemin Esrei, Chozer LaRosh, then in that particular case, he has to go back to the beginning of the davening. But it's beginning of Shemin Esrei, and Masavar, and the other authority felt that the Mokam Sheposach, that, you know, he goes back simply to the place where, you know, he
saw the,
where he interrupted his davening because he had this problem, all right? So, Omar Rav Ashi. So Rav Ashi said, Hayim Shoho, Imlay Shoh Miboyle says, first of all, what is his business if he waited, which is the meaning of Shoha? Imlo Shoha Miboyle. what it should say is, if he couldn't wait, right? Understand? He didn't wait. In other words, he urinated, you know, without any attempt to try to control himself. And the question is, how long should he try to control himself? So, Eladu Kuleyama. But, says Ravashi, according to everybody, Im Shaho Kidei Ligmas Kulo Chuzorosh, if the amount of time that he had to stop in the middle of the Shemoneh Esrei would be a length of time long enough, you know, to complete a Shemoneh Esrei, then in that particular case he has to go back to the beginning. So in that case, then what are these two authorities in disagreement? If everybody's in agreement that he has to go back, in other words, if he stopped, if he's paused for a lengthy period of time, then he has to go back and daven all over again. So if they're both in agreement, then the question is, what are they in disagreement?
Yeah.
So he says, so he says, now the disagreement rather is in this. The Mar Sovar Gavra Dekuyahu, one authority felt that he was literally a person who was literally cast down. It means is, you know, pushed aside.
Yeah.
But what it means is, you know, that he was, he had committed an act which was not good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But, or you could say, see, the chuyud also today means like under pressure.
Yeah, so, to postpone or push
right,
efforts and negate.
Yeah, it means literally to push off, yeah. Right. Or to be under pressure or something like that. So, one authority said he was a gavra dechuyo, right? Gavra dechuyo. In other words, he was a man who was under pressure, shall we say? The ein ra'ui, and it's not, you know, right, he's not worthy that, you know, the ein tefilo say tefilo, and as a result, Shemoneh Esrei, his prayer is not an acceptable prayer. But Mar Sovar and the other authority said, Gavra Chazyahu. On the contrary, he was a very fine person, and the fact that he had an accident, he had an accident. It was Omenton, you know.
Yeah.
Was Tefillah So Tefillah. But nevertheless, the Shemoneh Esrei is an acceptable prayer. Alright? So if he waits a certain amount of time, as long as it's a short period of time, then it's enough. But if it were, you know, a longer period of time, then he should go back and say Shemoneh Esrei over again. Tana Rabbanim. So now we come to another problem. Our sages taught us, Hanitzvach l'nekovah, what if a person has to go make a bowel movement? So he says, Al Yispalil, then he should not daven Shemoneh Esrei. If you know that you have to make, don't daven Shemoneh Esrei. Instead, what should you do? Of course, the answer is go to the bathroom and ease yourself, you see.
Yeah.
And of course, basically, you have to realize there are two reasons for it. Reason number one is the fact that in order to daven, you should have kavana. Okay? And you can't concentrate.
Maybe
the simple result. And of course,
we're jumping around, there's no kavana.
The other one is, if God forbid he does have, you know, something happen.
Yeah, an accident.
So, all right, it's, you know,
he's got excrement.
Case, exactly, he has excrement, and that's not, you know.
Then he becomes
he's
tummy.
Not in the proper
tummy.
It's not a question of being tummy. Tummy, we speak about.
Well, but it'd be,
right?
It'd be unclean.
But he is unclean. There's no question about that. And, you know, when you're daven, you should be in the state of cleanliness. Correct. So, all right. Let's continue just a little bit more. Yeah.
This becomes very, very complicated, very involved.
Right. So, all right. So, on this one, the Nakovi says, how you spell the yim his palel. And what if he did daven, in spite of the fact, you know, that he has
to go to the men's room.
He should have gone to the men's room, didn't. So tefiloso teyevo, then in that case his prayer is an abomination. Omer Rav Zvid said, v'yitema Rav Yehuda, and there are those who say it was Rav Yehuda who said it. He says, lei shonu, where did they teach this? Elo she'enu yochel l'hashvis batzba, where the man cannot simply control himself. But if it is possible to control himself a certain amount of time, right? In other words, at least through the time that he says the Shemoneh Esrei, And in that case, tefillah say tefillah.
So his shmones
were right, and he would be yosef with the daven. V'yad kamo, so how much, how long is this period of time? So I'm a Rav Sheshes. Rav Sheshes says it's ad parsa. He says it's as long as the period of time which it would take you to walk a parsa. Parsa is a Persian measure of distance, a parasang.
Parasang, yeah.
Right, which actually is more than a mile or something like that. So I guess if you could hold off, let's say, for a half hour or something like that, you know, you control yourself to that extent, then you can daven. But if you know that it's going to happen any moment, if you've got to run, then in that case, don't say Shemoneh Esrei, take care of your business first, and then
get back.
Right. And we'll learn also about taking off tefillin as we go on over here. All right, I think we'll stop at this particular point, the Shema HaMachah. Yeah. And okay, so next week we will meet again, the Mirza Hashem at 7:30. Okay. Davening, you know, moves up to 4:30 next week.
It'll be tough to get a minute together.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I hope we can do it. So we had in the Mishnah at the bottom of the previous page, so that you know, we'll have an idea of what we're dealing with, and then we'll start to do it. Okay.
45.
Right. Well, I'll start again on the bottom of 44 for a moment, because I'll start from the Mishnah so that it follows in order, okay? And we can understand a little bit better, you know, what the Mishnah is doing and what the Gemara is dealing with. Okay. So, let me first of all say that we're actually, the previous Dapim, you know, the previous pages dealt primarily with the problem of the Valkyrie. A person, you know, who suffers a flow of semen, and the fact that according to the Takana of Ezra, so he is prohibited from studying Torah, he is prohibited from saying Shema, which in Ezra there is a question, I mean, as to whether he could say it or not. Birkas HaMozen, they decided that the bracha beforehand, the hamotzi, he doesn't say it, but the birkas hamozen afterwards, he says it. Now, why does he say that? Because it says that that is already midaraisa, that's in the Torah, and therefore that he says the benching. But with tefillah, which is midarabanan, is a question, and midaraisa, again, is a question. This, in general, was Takana Ezra, and of course, we worked on it for several weeks, and we saw that in spite of the fact that you know, many of the authorities honored the prohibition against studying Torah or reciting Krishna during the time that a person was a Valkyrie, unless he had gone and toveled himself in the mikveh in order to cleanse himself, but there were two more lenient opinions. One lenient opinion that we discovered in the past couple of weeks was the fact that according to some authorities, if instead of immersing yourself in a mikveh, which contains 40 se'or, let's say it's 40 gallons, okay? I mean, I'm not giving you an exact measurement, but just to give you some idea of what it is, okay? Let's say 40 gallons of water as a minimum, right? In order to achieve purification, there's an opinion that if you have 9 kabim, which would be, let's say, like 9 quarts of water thrown over you, so in that case, that already made you clean enough in order to be able to study Torah and everything else. As I say, this was one of the opinions mentioned. Another slight variation on that was that if you're doing it for yourself, this was enough, but if you're going to teach others, then in that particular case, you should immerse yourself in the mikveh. But we also saw that many of the authorities, and particularly this was the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda ben Becerra, he said, first of all, a very important principle, which was that Ein Divrei Torah Mekablin Tumah, says that words of Torah cannot be susceptible to Tumah, you know, to uncleanliness. Okay? And I pointed out that on the basis of that, it is not prohibited to a woman, for example, to kiss a Sefer Torah. So that if a woman decides to kiss the Sefer Torah, we shouldn't be shocked by that, because according to the opinion of Ein Divrei Torah Mekablin Tumah, then in that particular case, the Torah is not going to be contaminated by virtue of the fact that a woman has kissed it, okay? So that's one thing. But to apply specifically to the you know, to the area that we were discussing, whether a person who was a Balkari would be permitted to study Torah. So we say, if we say that Ein Divrei Torah Mekablin Tumah, in other words, the Torah is not susceptible to it, then according to the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda ben Maseira, it is not required for a Balkari in order to, you know, to immerse himself in a mikveh in order to be able to recite Krishna or to study Torah. Okay? Now, this essentially is what we had, although there are all kinds of variations and permutations and everything else based upon it. In discussing the reason why did Ezra HaSofer, in other words, why did he make such a takana, you know, in other words, such a decree, so to speak, you know, that as to say that you shouldn't learn Torah or you shouldn't say Krishna if you were a Balkari? Essentially, it was for two reasons. Reason number one was the comparison given to the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai. What does it say about the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai? It says over there,
right,
that the people had to abstain for 3 days, and obviously not only did they have to abstain, but, you know, it's written, you know, that they have to cleanse themselves, cleanse their garments and so on. Obviously, how was that done? Was it done, you know, in a mikvah or a stream, whatever they had over there.
Right.
So that they had to prepare themselves in order to receive the Torah. So that when we say Krishna, or when we study Torah, we too should have exactly the same feeling of Yirah, you know, fear of the Rabbeinu Shalom, I mean, the sense of awe, sense of reses, trembling, zeyah, sweat, and everything else, and so on. Or according to others, it's not zeyah, but ziyah, which means that, you know, you should feel moved, you should tremble, and so on. So that this is the attitude. In other words, don't take, for example, the reciting of Krishna as just something that you rattle off automatically, but take it as an experience in which you want to really show your haftas of the Shem and the Kepha, you see, that you love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul. And if you approach the, you know, that way, then it's an entirely different feeling than, as I say, I mean, just you know, rattling it off to see if you can do it in about 30 seconds flat.
It was.
This reminds me, many, many years ago when I first came to Springfield, and I taught for a year in the United Hebrew School. So that was one of the things. I would teach the kids, you know, how to, let's say Krishna, and then we would time it, you know, see how many seconds it would take you to go through the first paragraph of the Krishna. And the general race time was
30 seconds.
30 seconds. But I wouldn't recommend it. It takes me more than 30 seconds to recite the Krishna. So as I say, that was reason number one for the Takana of Ezra, that we should have this feeling of awe and trembling and trepidation and you name it, all the adjectives. The rabbi is very good at these adjectives. In reciting the Shema. The other one is the fact that he felt that as far as learning Torah is concerned, he didn't want men to be hanging around their women all the time. So that if he made it tougher for them by saying, look, every time that you have a seminal mission, you have to go into a mikveh, so, you know, that they wouldn't hang around with them so often. But on the other hand, the feeling then, you know, so why did they do away with it? So as we learned, because right, it was my theory of a rivia, you see. It was interfering with the mitzvah that you're supposed to have children, you see. You're supposed to be fruitful to multiply.
But not all the time.
Right, okay.
So is the decision of Rabbi Yehuda
ben Maseira, right,
is the...
Not to be confused with five other Yehudas.
Yehudas, right.
Okay.
Is that generally accepted by all segments?
Yeah, that was accepted as the halacha.
Even by the people who are mafia?
They may not have accepted it upon themselves, but the question is, how about our acceptance of the halacha? What halacha do we follow? So obviously, already from the time of Tosfos, where they say that this is it, you see, this becomes
even
the halacha.
Time of Tosfos.
Yeah, time and place was. In other words, for at least the past 1,000 years,
that's the way it's been.
We have accepted this halacha, and you can be sure that even prior to that, there were many, many authorities who sided with Rabbi Yehuda ben Maseira. Even so, I mean, even in spite of the fact that page after page dealt with all the authorities who had different opinions. But, you know, remember that when we study Torah, we want to try to understand the motivation, the background, and everything else that we have over here. And then if we can paskin a halacha, so we paskin. So all the objections were stated again, 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 objections, counter-objections, etc., etc. But in the final analysis, what is the halacha in this particular case? Halacha follows Rabbi Yehuda ben Bezalel. And this is the reason why we don't require it anymore. Okay. So, all right. I want to start once more from the Mishnah. We had actually gone already for about 5-10 lines on the next page over there, but in order to understand, you know, what we're dealing with, to get a total picture, it's good to start from the Mishnah again. Besides, a little review is always in place, okay?
We can use it.
Right. That is assuming that we were all here last week. Some people didn't make it last week, so all the more reason then, okay? All right, so the Mishnah at the bottom of Chof Beis on the base says, Hohoyah made bitvila. A person was standing Shemun Esra. Vinizkar Shehu Balkeri. And in the middle of the Shemun Esra, he suddenly remembered that he was a Balkeri. And remember again, we're going back again, you know, to the business about the Takon of Esra. So what does the Mishnah say about the Balkeri? It says, Lo Yafsik El Yekatzer. Okay? He should not interrupt his saying Shemun Esra, but what should he do? He should shorten the brachas. We couldn't quite figure out exactly how you shorten the brachas, except that we gave the example of some people who daven for the Omid over here, that they say the first sentence and the last sentence of Fafik.
I don't think that's the answer, though.
Well, maybe, I don't know.
Does Rashi say anything about that?
He doesn't. That's the whole thing. Yeah, you take a look. Take a look at the Rashi. It says, Lo Yafsik, you shouldn't interrupt the Velosi the Gamri completely. Elo Yekatzer, called Brocha Brocha. Shorten each Brocha. The Yomir Kola Brochas Bekoitzer. And he should say all the Brochas as shortly as he possibly could.
Bekoitzer.
Yeah. So I suppose, let's say, take one posik, I mean, one phrase or something from the Brocha, and then the Baruch Ator Hashem, you know, whatever it may be, okay? Like Atochenim Das, Lamin Mishvino, Baruch Ator Hashem, Chena Das, okay? So you see, that if you have already the idea, you know, that we thank God, you know, for giving us knowledge, Baruch Ator Hashem, Chena Das. So, you know, Chodeinim Yitko, this is already additional, you see, in which we say, God, grant us wisdom too. You understand? So the same thing. Hashiveinu Avinu Sorosecha, right? Bring us near to your Torah, Baruch Ator Hashem, or Reitzim Sishuva, right?
Right.
So you can see that it could be done if you do, you know, a phrase at the beginning and then the bracha at the end. So I have to assume that this is what they had in mind.
But you're only supposed to do that if you're a Balkeri.
A Balkeri, right. We already learned in the first chapter, if you remember, that what happens if a person is pressed for time. It's a great emergency, okay? Or if a person is sick and he can't say the entire Shemun Esra, is there an abridged form of the Shemun Esra? The answer is yes, and we saw that the abridged form, which incidentally the text we'll find a little bit later when we start the fourth chapter, okay, the abridged form is one paragraph beginning at Hashem, Havidenu at Hashem, oh grant us, oh God, you know, knowledge, and you know, enable us to do tshuva and forgive our sins and so on, wherein we take one idea from each of the brachas, and then we conclude the whole thing by saying Baruch Ator Hashem Shemeyat Tfila, and they have to recite the first three brachas, you know, Baruch Ator Hashem Elokim Hoseinu and so on, you know, Ator Gibor and Ator Kodesh. Then you say this, and after the Shemet Vil, you conclude with Ritzei, Emodim, and Sim Shalom, okay? So, this is the abridgment, and this is accepted as being permissible, as I said, where either time is so urgent, you have to go on a journey or something like that, whatever it may be, or if a person is ill and he can't do the whole thing. However, there are two exceptions. Well, one basically, yeah, but there are two exceptions where they say you shouldn't do it. What are the two exceptions? One exception is, of course, Saturday night, Mitzvah Shabbos. Why not? What is there in the Yishmanesra Saturday night, Mitzvah Shabbos?
Jewish would say so.
That's what's Shmoneser.
Oh, you mean Atachanan,
of course. In other words, the Havdalah.
Sure,
it's Havdalah. I mean, that, essentially what we're
really
saying is
right.
Okay. So, because we have to recite the Havdalah, Mitzvah is Shabbos, therefore we cannot use the Jewish version. And then there's one other time during the year when we can't do it. What did you say, David?
No, I'm just thinking of the question.
Okay. During the course of the year, there's another time when we cannot say this abridged version. Also, because of the fact that there's something that we have to add, which is not found in here.
Would it be during a yontif like the
No. I'm not talking about yontif. Yontif has its own shemitah. Yeah.
So you're talking about.
No.
The answer is, of course, when we have to say talamotar.
Oh, talamotar.
When we have to say talamotar, because talamotar, you know, that we be
right.
In Eretz Yisrael, they begin saying it on the seventh day of Cheshvan.
Right.
In other words, in Eretz Yisrael, they're already reciting, you know, talamotar right until the first day of Pesach, right?
Right.
Through Erev Pesach, right. We in the Gola, we follow the practice that was. The practice of the Golos and Bovel, which was that we begin saying it the 60th day after the beginning of the fall season. So it normally this time of the year it comes around December 4, December 5 and so on that we begin saying it.
So that means you can't say it all during that period of time.
That's right, we can't say the abridged version because we have to add Talamotar. So those are the two periods during the year that we can't do it. Either might say Shabbos or during the time that we have to say Talamotar. So then we can't use the abridged version. But any other time, we're permitted to do it.
But that would be the month of December, January, February, March up to Pesach.
Correct.
There would be a third time when you couldn't say. You couldn't use the abridged version when you even on a minor tonus, because you have to say certain prayers during that.
Okay. Technically, the person who is simply saying Shmoneser for himself could be Yotzi with the Shmoneser on a tonus, and I'll tell you why. The Gemara in Tainus, to be more exact, I mean it's Tosfos and the Gemara Tainus. So say they speak about Anenu, you know, the prayer that we say, okay, and there it. You know, there are two different practices. One is the practice of the Sephardim, and the other one is the practice of the Ashkenazim. Now, the Sephardim have the practice that in Shachris, they also, in the Shtilish Menesvus, we say, they say Anenu. And certainly to Mincha, they say it. In the Ashkenazic practice, actually, we only say in the Shtilish Menesvus. You know what I mean by the Shtilish Menesvus?
Yeah.
Oh, the silent prayer. Okay, in Yiddish you call it the Stillish Manasseh, okay? Still in Yiddish means silent, okay? You heard Shah, still, right? Okay, yeah. So the Stillish Manasseh, in other words, in the silent prayer, we say it only to Mincha. The question is sometimes been asked. If you take a look in the Siddur that we use all the time, you'll see that they have Anenu both to Shachris and to Mincha. So, I've been asked already the question on more than one occasion. Oy vey, I forgot to say Anenu. So I said, you don't have to say it, because our custom is not to say it, during Shabbos. We only say it to Mincha. The reason why, incidentally, why is it said to Mincha? Because at Shabbos, you may not be sure whether you'll be able to fast the entire day. But if you daven Mincha, just at the end of the day, then you know that you will fast the whole day, so it's appropriate to say Anenu. This is the basic reason why, okay? All right, so we're talking, when we say, this abridged version of the Shmonesra, we are talking about a person who's davening for himself. We're not talking about a tzibor, we're davening with a minion. When you daven with a minion, it's already a different story. Then you say the entire Shmonesra, and, the Chazal, when he repeats, he does what the Gemara says, and again, the Gemara and Tainus. As a matter of fact, Gemara and Tainus mentions that they had several brachas that they used to add, separate brachas, in order to pray for rain.
That's all right.
Yeah. To pray for rain, this was one of the basic reasons why they fasted Ta'anesim. I'm not talking about, you know, the Ta'anes Tibur like Shibas of Atamiz or some Gedalia and so on. These already we have accepted upon ourselves as being, you know, Ta'anes Tibur, as being fast observed by entire congregation, okay? But in Eretz Israel, they used to proclaim also additional fast days if the rain had not fallen by a certain date. And then more Ta'anesim. If even after, you know, the first group of prayers, there was still a drought, it had not yet rained and so on. So that there's a whole series. Now there they also mention different brachas that were recited. One of them is of course bracha which is similar to the Anenu that we say, with the bracha, bracha HaRashem Ha'onu V'Yesetzora, right? Which is the conclusion of that bracha with the person starting for the Yamin. But then they also had several other brachas that they recited. We find it would be interesting sometime, I mean, to take a look at that and see. But first let's get to our business at hand over here. Alright, so those are the times when you can't do it, okay? But the Katzer that they speak about over here, as we see from Rashi, he says just rush through the Shemoneh Esrei somehow or other by just taking a phrase at the beginning and making a brach at the end and so on, that's where you finish. Alright, so with this we are almost finished with the business of Al-Keri, at least they don't get around to it again for some time, but we're now going to talk about other problems that human beings face, either in their own physical problem or it may be because of where they are saying. Alright, so this is now what the Mishnah deals with, okay? Remember at all times, tefillah is an important thing. Remember also that sanitation in those days is not exactly what we have today when we have indoor flush toilets. In those days, the luxury did not exist. The best that they could do was to have a Beis HaKisei. And the Beis HaKisei reminds me of some places out in the country, you know.
Outhouse.
Right, the outhouse. This is exactly what it was. Okay. So that this is what a Beis HaKisei was. Okay, so now they ask the following question. All right, Yorad Lidbo. Now here they're talking about any person who went in order to toivel himself in a mikveh. Okay, and many people, of course, obviously had the habit of doing what some Hasidim do today, except that, you know, the Hasidim normally do it only, let's say, on Shabbos or on Yontiv, that they'll go and they'll immerse themselves in the mikveh before they go to daven. Okay, but in those days where some other, there were people who took the trouble to go and immerse themselves in the mikveh every day before they went to daven. Okay, or let's say even that the person was a Baal Keri. Let's follow along with the idea. He was a Baal Keri. He wanted to be Mekayim, you know, to fulfill the Takon of Ezra, and so he went into the mikveh in order to be able to daven in the morning. Okay, so here he is in the mikveh. Okay, Yorad Lidbol. So it says, Im yochol la'aleis v'liskasis v'likreis ha'shloi tehevanis hatam or yalav yiskasim. If he can get out of the mikveh, clothe himself, cover himself literally, and read Krishna just before Hanetz HaKama, which was the recommended time in the Mishnah. In other words, when ideally should you recite Krishna in the morning? The answer is just before sunrise. Just before sunrise. So that when you finish at sunrise with the Baruch Baruch Atah Hashem Gal Yisrael, and immediately begin Shemoneh Esrei. This is what we learned again in the first chapter as being the ideal time for davening chakras in the morning. Okay? So if he can do all these things, then in that particular case, he should. He gets up from the mikveh and he covers himself and he reads. Okay? Now, the Yimlav, and what if he doesn't have time enough to do it? Then it says, Yiskasi b'mayim v'yikvah, then he should cover himself simply in the water. In other words, if you're in the mikveh, the water of the mikveh is considered as being sufficient covering that you should be able to recite a bracha, or in this case, the Shema Yisrael. Okay? Now, of course, it's understood. You're not supposed to be looking down at your private parts, you see, at that particular time, or touch any private parts or anything like that. But the water itself is the covering. And remember what I told you about the time, you know, when does a woman recite the bracha in the mikveh? And the answer is after she has she has covered herself completely with water in the mikveh. She is not dressed. I mean, she's, you know, the way our Mother Eve was at that time. But by covering herself with water, she is permitted to make the bracha at that point. So there's a parallel situation over here. Now, however, the Mishnah says, "Belo yiskase lo b'mayim haroyim v'lo b'mei hamishra, ad sheyotu l'seichen mayim." All right. It says, however, that he should not cover himself with water in order to, you know, recite Krishna if this water is mayim haroyim, which could be taken in one of two ways. Way number one would be to simply take it, you know, literally, bad water. What is bad water? Dirty water or something like that, okay? But in reality, Rashi has a different understanding of it. And, you know, he takes it in the sense, you know, that actually somebody had urinated in the water. This is the idea, okay? It's water which contains urine in it. So in that case, he cannot, you know, recite anything until you've poured in more water, obviously in order to be able to
dilute
it, right, exactly, okay? All right. Nor in Mei Mishra. Mei Mishra, as I explained to you, in those days, a lot of people made their own clothing out of flax which they had grown. And so flax, in order to become useful, that you can begin to take fibers out of it, you know, so that you could spin linen, it has to be soaked. And when it's soaked in water, it gives off an odor which is not very pleasant, okay? So they would do it in their bathtub or in whatever it may be, in a big pot or something, they would soak it. So you should not, you know, immerse yourself in a mikveh, in other words, which contains flax that has also been thrown inside over there because of the odor that you have. And it's not fitting, it's not proper to recite Krishna when the environment, you know, is bad, because obviously it's a lack of honor for the whole commitment to recite Krishna, and at the same time it distracts you, you see, from what the ideal situation should be. I mean, after all, it's best if you can daven with the least amount of interference. I'm sure that many of you may have had the experience, you know, that let's say that you can't make it to the shul to daven. Okay? So you daven at home. The radio is going, the television is playing, right? Somebody asks you a question in the middle and things like that. You realize that there are all kinds of interruptions, and you can't really put your mind on the davening to the same extent as when you come over here to shul and you're with a minion and everybody is concentrating on the prayers, or at least we hope that everybody is concentrating on the prayers. It's a different atmosphere, you see.
Ninja teenage turtles.
Right.
While you're
dubbing. While we're dubbing, right. Yeah. Okay. So far, now we've talked about that. Now, v'chama yarchik mehen, and how far should a person step away, either from this mayim haroyim that we spoke about, or the mei mishra, right, u'min hatzoah, or from excrement? The answer is dalet amos. You have to remove yourself at least 4 amos. 4 amos would be at least 6 feet away. At least 6. Taking the minimum measurement, which says that an amo is roughly 18 inches. There are those who say it's 24 inches. Some who say 20 inches. You know, I'm not going to argue how much is an amo. But the point is, anywhere from 6 feet or a little further. Okay? Mm-hmm. All right. So, Tana Rabbanan. So we start first of all with a Baraisa. Baraisa says, Hoyoimi bat fila. What if a person was saying Shmoneh Esrei v'nizkar shehu balkeri, and he remembered that he was balkeri? This is, if you remember, what is the first thing that was mentioned in the Mishnah.
Mm-hmm.
So it says, Lo yasif ka liyakatsya, right? Good. So all that we've done at this particular point so far is simply to quote the first part of the Mishnah that we've done.
Mm-hmm.
But now it adds something, and it says, Hoyakori bat Torah. What if a person was reading the Torah? Okay? Now, it could even, it doesn't necessarily mean that he was reading the Torah in public. It could also mean simply, you know, that a person was studying Torah. Okay? Nizkar Shahu Balkeri, and at the moment, and then he suddenly remembers that he's a Balkeri. So it says, Einu Mavsik V'Eile, then in that particular case, he does not interrupt and stop whatever he's doing, Ele Megam Gein V'Kore, but he simply sort of stammers, in other words, he runs through the text, and he reads whatever he's doing, but, you know, not distinctly, not slowly, and so on. Dave?
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
You said Mafsik Viola means what?
Over here, Mafsik Viola means that, you know, simply that he stops, and he interrupts, literally, Mafsik the Oila, and
Mafsik Gain.
Yeah, right. And he departs with, another possibility is simply that Mafsik Gain simply means that he stops, but then he continues, or he interrupts himself, but continues Elma Gamki in the Kore. But what does he do? He doesn't do it distinctly, but instead he simply rushes through it. Literally, he stammers through it, or he rushes through it.
Megamgam.
Yeah, Megamgam. Gamgam means literally that he stammers, okay? But Rashi takes it. Take a look at the Rashi over there, and you see Megamgam gives one word, translation. It says Bimarutsa. Bimarutsa means in a rush. Okay? So he gets over it, I mean, whatever passion he's doing, he simply rushes through it. Rabbi Meir Eimer, Rabbi Meir says, Ein Balkeri, Rasha Likras Batorah, he says, no Balkeri is permitted to read in the Torah, Yosem and Gimel Psukim, more than just three Psukim. And of course, we know, I mean, that this is in relation to the fact that when we read from the Torah, the minimum that we can read is three Psukim, and the Gemara Megillah sort of, you know, derives it from the idea of Cain, Levi, of Israel, and so on. So that this is how they come to the fact that the minimum passage is three psukim. Okay? So that this leads to a problem when it comes to the Kriya for Rosh Chodesh.
That's why you have to repeat some of those phrases.
Correct. That's why we repeat
some of those sentences.
In the second Aliyah, we repeat, exactly. The Shulchan Aruch recommends this, but there's another opinion also mentioned, which reads right through to the end, and then they go back again and read, and so on.
Start over again.
Huh?
Yeah. Like you're doing
right.
Some Torah.
Right. So you have different practices, but of course the practice that we follow is the one which is recommended, first of all, by the Shulchan Aruch, and secondly, this is the accepted practice in practically all the shuls.
So
Rabbi Meir says that the Balkeri is not permitted to do more than three psukim. Tanya Yiddich, we also have another baraisa which says, Hoyemi bat tilo, what if a person was standing Shein Shmoneh Esrei v'ro tzoya kenegdo, and all of a sudden he notices that there's excrement in front of him. So what happens? Mahalech lefonov, then in that case it says that he should walk forward Achi Zekened Acharov, until literally he can throw it behind him, but it doesn't mean that he picks it up and throw it. That's for shalom. What it means is that he leaves it behind him. Okay? So if he walks far enough, he goes Dalet Amos, and in other words,
then he'd have
step,
to start Shmoneh
Esrei right,
all over again.
Right. So he can continue. Okay? Alright. So this is, as I say, it's another Baraisa over here that they quote at this particular point. So now they say, but didn't we learn in different Baraisa which says that he should step to the side, not walk ahead, you know, but step to the side? So like Kasha, they say, no, there's not a contradiction. Where it's possible to step forward, you step forward. But where you can't, then what do you do? Then you step to the side. Okay? And as Rashi says, where is it impossible? All right, let's say you're facing a wall, or you're in front of a river, and so on, where if you go forward, you have no place, you'll wind up in the water, you see. So in that particular case, step to the side. Okay. Now, Matzke play Rava. So Rava, excuse me, I left out something. Right. Ahoyim is Palil. Now, what if he was saying Shmoneh Esrei Motzat Tzoa Bimkomo, and all of a sudden he sees that right where he's standing, right, there is excrement. So I'm a Rabba, so Rabba said, Afal Pi Shechoto, even though he sinned, by virtue of the fact that he should have been more careful where he was saying, you know, where he's standing when he's saying Shmoneh Esrei, but Filosot Filov, he says, but nevertheless, the davening, Or Zebach v'shoyim te'evot, didn't King Solomon say that the sacrifice of the wicked is an abomination to the Ribbono Shel Olam? So in other words, the davening, which is like a sacrifice, as we see, and certainly we'll have it later on when we do the fourth chapter, we're getting closer and closer to it. So there we'll see that one of the things, that they see a basis for the Shemoneh Esrei in the times of the daily sacrifice. In other words, the Shacharis corresponds to the time when they had the morning sacrifice. The Mincha, when they had the afternoon sacrifice. Musaf, on those days in which they had the additional sacrifices. Of course, at night there was none, so therefore there's no repetition incidentally, as you notice, the Shemoneh Esrei at night. And there was also a difference of opinion as to whether it was obligatory or whether it was voluntary to recite the Krishna at night, to recite the Shemoneh Esrei at night. This we'll go into when we get to it, for that, with God's help, okay?
Right.
But, yes, David.
I'd just like to know, what is the differentiation between
Omei
Batfila and Hayam Batfila? Yeah.
Standing. Omei B'tfilah means literally standing saying Shemoneh Esrei, that's all. Standing. Not really.
Okay.
Not really.
Right.
Yeah. Because, as you notice, practically everywhere that we've come across the word tefillah, it was really in reference to the Shemoneh Esrei. Yeah. So that the two are really synonymous over here. Okay. So Rabba said that his tefillah is tefillah, right? But Rabba disagrees with him and says that, look, inasmuch as King Solomon said that the sacrifice of the wicked is an abomination, so rather said Rabba, hoil v'chata, inasmuch as he has sinned, hoil means inasmuch as, okay? Inasmuch as he has sinned, so afal pisha is palal, even though he is daven Shemoneh Esrei, tefillah so to'eva. His prayer is an abomination. And so, both Tosfos and also the marginal note point out the fact then that according to Rava, what should he do? The answer is, he should find another place.
Remove himself six
and daven Shemoneh Esrei over
again.
This is what he recommends, okay? It's not here in the text, but this is how both Tosfos and also the marginal note, which happens to be the Rashal over there, they recommend that this is what he should be doing. Okay. So, we continue now. Tana Rabbanan. Here we spoke about the fact that you see excrement. Yeah. So that's case number one. Now that's okay. Please, feel free. Feel free. Believe me, that as a teacher, I enjoy answering any question. Right, or Abai Shalomed, absolutely. Everybody who studied Pirkei Avos should be familiar with that statement. Yeah.
I guess we won't start learning if you have no patience.
Yeah, well, Kapton Melamed, it says. Right, right. Abai Shalom, right. Lamed below a Kapton Melamed. Right, exactly.
We certainly have a great deal of patience.
Yeah.
I just wanted, again, for my own information.
Yeah.
Was Rabba's son?
No.
Is Rabba was first in time, I say. Rabba was earlier as that.
Yeah, Rabba, actually, the most famous Rabba happened to be Rabba Bar Huna. He was the most famous one. There are a couple of other Rabbas, too. I think it was a Rabba Bar Abohu, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, this you can find out if you have, one of these great big indices, to the Talmud, where they list all kinds of the Goyim. So on, yeah.
Rava
was the one who was the contemporary of Abaye, who was always arguing. The two of them were always over here. The first one was Rava. He was the one who said, "Okay, tefilaso to'eva." Okay, but Rava, the one who normally is in disagreement with Abaye, but as we see, can be in disagreement with other people too. You see, so he says no. He has to daven over again because this tefillah of his, this was a toevo. It was an abomination to God because he was not careful as to where he was standing at the time of the Shemoneh Esrei.
So there's several Rabbas.
Yes. Right, right. Well, the one could have been a little bit earlier, one a little later, you know, that for that you really have to study, you know, Sforum which deal with this. I think, I know that you have the first volume of Steinsaltz.
Yeah, they have it now.
So I think that he has over there a phonology of
yes,
different authorities. There are other books too where they have, you know, something along these lines. Actually, the original work and the chronology, this was done way, way back by Rav Sharira Gaon, roughly about the year 700, 800, maybe 900. That's when he first, you know, tried to make heads and tails out of who and which generation and so on and so forth. So that became the standard historical reference. And of course the Rambam made great use of Rav Sharira Gaon's Tolis Amoraim and Tanoim and Amoraim and so on. Of course now we have, you know, later books that have been written in the 19th, 20th century and so on, put them all in their perspective.
Was
yes,
Sharira Gaon one of the Babylonian
Gaonians? Yeah, right. In other words, the Babylonian, you know, the Babylonian academies, we mustn't think, you know, that they ceased with the
return to
the return that already goes back 500 before the Common Era. Okay, but the Babylonian yeshivas, okay,
remain.
Well, they really began functioning more when Rav and Shmuel returned to Babylonia after having studied in Eretz Israel. They were natives of Babylonia, but they came back from Eretz Israel after studying with Rabbi Yehuda Anasi and the great scholars of his day, the great Tanoim, and they became the founders of the newly established yeshivas in Babylonia. There were schools functioning, but they really put Babylonia academies on the map, okay? Babylonian yeshivas. So, both of the schools, the one which was founded by Rav and the one which was founded by Shmuel, they continued functioning for many, many centuries afterwards. Now, the Babylonian Talmud, the Babli, that we study, this was Ravino and Ravashi. They were the final redactors, so to speak, of the Gemara. Now that was approximately the year 500 of our Common Era, okay? But the Babylonian academies continued for at least another 500 years. So what did they have? This is the beginning of, first they had a group of people who were called the Saburoyim, in other words, the people who were trying to reason out, you know, what is it? And then you had the Gaonim. They began to use the title Gaon for the head of the academy. Sura and Kumbhadesa, these were the two main academies, okay? So each one was the Gaon. So Rav Sharira Gaon was one of the early Gaonim, and then you have others like Rav Haigon and so on, okay? So this is why we speak about the Gaonic period, and of course probably the most famous of all of them is Rav Saadia Gaon.
Saadia Gaon, yeah.
Right, who really was one of the great, great luminaries of this period. But they're all, I mean, every one of them are very, very important.
Great scholars.
Right. Important, first of all, for their understanding of what the Talmud was. After all, they were closer to the people of the Talmud than we are today. So if they had an opinion, you see, we have to see, how did they understand the text? Even if we understand it a little differently today, but how did they understand it, you see? And then also, they became voluminous writers of Shadas and Shubas. Many of them have first been published in the last few years. But, you know, they had thousands of questions that were sent to them from all over the Jewish world of that day, whether it was in Spain or France or North Africa and so on. They would address the Shadas and Shubas to the Gaonim, right, to the yeshivas in Babel, because then they were recognized as the preeminent scholars. Okay, when did the preeminence cease? Ceased actually for two reasons. One of them is the fact that new centers arose in other parts, as for example in Cairo 1 in North Africa, it became a great center also.
What?
Cairo.
Cairo 1. It's Morocco.
Morocco.
Yeah, Morocco. So that became a big center of learning in North Africa. And then, of course, yeshivas were started in France and in Spain. And, you know, as these schools developed, I mean, when you have people like, let's say, Rabbeinu Gershom and Rashi, and, of course, the Rambam, and people like that. So these were great giants of learning, and so the preeminence of the schools of Babylonia faded in comparison by this time. But of course the other reason was the fact that the Mohammedans, the Arabs, at first they were fairly tolerant, but you know, you would always have also eras of intolerance. Now for example, in you know, Babel, which was really related to Persia, the you know, you had the whole Shiite movement started already, and in those days were already playing a cup with their Shiite philosophy and everything else. So that eventually they put an end. The yeshivas can no longer exist over there. But in the meantime, as I say, as the sun was setting over there, so the sun had risen already
over France, over Spain.
Right.
Did they migrate to that area? Did they leave Babel at that time?
Many Jews remain. Not everybody, but others did. Yeah. Oh, sure, definitely. They may have gone, let's say, to southern Russia, the Crimea over there. You had the kingdom of the Khazars that you may have heard about.
The
king of the Khazars, the king became a convert to Yiddishkeit and others and so on. And of course, this formed the foundation of a very important work called the Kuzari by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. And it's one of the early books of Jewish philosophy, although Saadia Gaon had already written also a book called Emunos V'Deos, in other words, beliefs and knowledge and so on, beliefs and ideas and so on. And Yehuda Halevi based his philosophy upon this incident of the Kuzari, that the king of the Khazars, he challenges the representatives of Judaism, of Islam, and of Christianity to prove their religion. And it's one of the great works, a very, very interesting work of the you know, the medieval period. We are so rich in literature, and there are so many magnum opuses. I'm purposely not doing it in the Latin. The Latin plural would be a little different. But you know what I mean by magnum opus. I mean a great work and so on that we have, that a lifetime isn't time enough, really, to do all the learning that we should, to do all the reading that we should, do all the studying and thinking and so on and so on. But listen, we have to do what we can. You know what it says in Perek? Le'alecham locho ligmur, le'ato ben chen hibbote b'men. It says that you can't do the whole job by yourself. But on the other hand, it doesn't mean that therefore you're excused, you know, not to even attempt it.
Right.
You have to try.
So,
okay.
Where are we?
Yes. So we're down at the bottom over there. Okay. So now the next problem that we have. Tana Rabbanan, the rabbis taught us, Hoyoy mei bat fila. The man was standing Shemin Esra, Umayim Shreisus in Abirkov. And suddenly he sees he can't control his urination, and he starts urinating. Literally on his knees, okay? In other words, he sees that, you know. Okay. And,
where's the davening done? Outside or inside, basically?
Could be anywhere. Could be outside, inside, so.
But
many of them were done outside, yeah.
Well, I know at the Wheel of Mourning you can do it outside.
Right, yeah. But the point is, I mean, we know, I mean, that there are people, I mean, for various reasons, I mean, there are many men, they simply become incontinent at times. Not saying all the time, but at times, right? You can't control your bladder, okay? So what happens in such a case where you can't control yourself? So they say, Poisek, then you have to stop until literally the water ceases, in other words, until you know the urine stops flowing. The chayzer, and then he returns, mispalim, and you know he continues davening. So now the question is, heichon chozer, so where does he go back to? So this already, there's a difference of opinion. Rav Chista and Rav Hamnuna. There's a difference of opinion between Rav Chista and Rav Hamnuna. Chad omar chozer l'chayzer, one of them says he had to go back to the beginning of the Shemoneh Esra. The chad omar, and the other one says the mokim sheposam. You continue from the place where you interrupted your Shemoneh Esra. So, Lema Behokam Iflike, are we to say that the difference between these two, between Rav Chisla and Rav Hanuna, consists in the fact that Mar Sovar Im Shohak De Ligmer is Kula Chisla Rosh and Mar Sovar Im Mokim Sheposak? Are we to say that if a person had to stop long enough in order to finish the entire Shemoneh Esra, then in that case, he has to go back to the beginning. Umar Sova and the other one said, no, even if he had to stop for a while, you know, for a rather lengthy time, but still he goes back to the place where he'd stopped. Is this what the Machlekes is about? Is this what the difference of opinion is about? Some of Ravashi, so Ravashi said, no. Difference of opinion is a different one. He says, Haim Shoho, Im Lei Shoho, Miboy Lei. If that were the case, he says, it wouldn't say Im Shoho if he waited. But it would say Imlay Shah if he didn't wait. This is how the reading should be. Elo de Chuleyama. But rather, says Rav Ashi, everybody, in other words, both of these authorities, it means, are in agreement, Im Shoho Kate Ligmar Skulo Chizal Rosh. That if you had to stop for that period of a time in which you could have finished the entire Shemoneh Esra, then in that case you have to start all over again, right? Bahasam, but rather, what is the argument about Bidaloishahakamiflagay? The question is only where there was no lengthy stop in between. Damar Sovar, one was of the opinion that Gabra de Fuyahu, that this man was in a state of emergency, the Ein Ra'ui, but his prayer is not worthy because he should have anticipated, so to speak, the emergency, the Ein Tfilose Tfilo. And therefore his Shemoneh Esra is not, you know, a Shemoneh Esra. So that, in other words, he has to go back again, Chozer L'Rosh, right? He has to go back to the beginning and say Shemoneh Esra all over again. Gomar Sovar, on the other authority, he said, Gavra Chaz Yehu. He says, no, the man was a good man, was Filosot Tefilot. The fact that he had to stop for a moment, no, okay, but, you know, otherwise he was a fine gentleman. Good to yield, and the prayer that he's offering is a prayer. Therefore, all that he has to do is to continue from where he left off. Okay. So that is as far as a person who is incontinent, and, you know, what should he do if suddenly, you know, he suddenly has to urinate in the middle of davening. Okay. Now we come to another one. Hanitzrach l'nekalva. What if a person has a bowel movement? Okay. So it says, if a person has a bowel movement, al yispalim, then he should not say Shemoneh Esra. In other words, if you feel that you got to go, don't say Shemoneh Esra. Go, but not Shemoneh Esra.
Not Shemoneh Esra.
Al yispalim, don't. Right.
Before or after.
Right. The im yispalim, and if he says Shemoneh Esra, tefilosei to'evo, then he says, you know, that his prayer is an abomination because he should have gone to the bathroom, you know, before saying Shemoneh Esra. Omer Rav Zvid, so Rav Zvid said, V'itema Rav Yehuda, and there are those who say it wasn't Rav Zvid, but it was Rav Yehuda. He says, Leishonu, Ela Shenu Yochel L'Hashay Zviyatma. He says, where are they talking about? They're talking about where a person cannot hold it in. Avolim Yochel L'Hashay Zviyatma. But if he can hold it in, then Tfilasoy Tfilah. Then his Shemoneh Esra is a valid Shemoneh Esra. So now the question is, v'yad kama, how long should a person be able to hold it in? This is the question. Mm-hmm. How long should a person be able to hold it in for us to say that his davening is a valid davening? So I'm a Rav Sheshes said, ad parsa. He says, if a person, you know, it would be, if a person could hold himself in, the amount of time that it would take to walk a parasang, which happens to be a rather...
It's
more than a mile. All right, so those days they figured that a mile, as a minimum, would take you 15 minutes to walk a mile. Okay? That's the way they think. Yeah, just walking. I mean, I'm not talking about running or jogging or anything like that. Okay? But to walk a mile, according to some, it's 15 minutes. According to some, it's 12 minutes. According to others, it's 20 minutes. Okay? This is why you have different interpretations as to, for example, when should you daven Maariv, because it's based upon this difference of opinion as to how much is a meal, which of course was the Roman mile too, not necessarily, you know, the English mile, you understand, okay? Meal in Latin is really the word mille, mille passus, which means 1,000 paces. So if you could figure out how long, first of all, what is the distance that 1,000 paces would be, you know, when a person walks like this, right? And then figure out how long it would take, you know, to walk this mile, so this would be it. So, in other words, if you could hold it in, let's say, for 15 minutes, 20 minutes, but let's say the parasang would take a half hour or something like that, okay? So if you could hold it in that long, then in that case, you daven Shmoneh Esrei and it's all right. But if you can't hold it in for any length of time, then you shouldn't, okay? This is what he's saying. Ikar d'maasin lo amas nisan. There are those who apply this last statement of Rav Zvid to what we have had just a moment ago. Bamed devar maburim. In other words, they say, you know, if you can't hold it in, don't. If you can't hold it in, hold it in. But what are we talking about? Kishen yochel lamed alatzbo. We're talking about where a person can't hold it in. Avol im yochel lamed alatzbo. But if he can control it, tfilot so it's tfilot, and his Shmoneh Esrei is valid. Viat kamo, and how long? So on the Zvid, ad parsa. Alright, so as we see, there were two different versions, but they boil down to about the same thing. Alright. Omer Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmani. Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmani said the following. Omer Rabbi Yonasan, in the name of Rabbi Yonasan, he says, Hanitzvach l'nikova. What if a person has to have, you know, he feels he has to have a bowel movement? Tzarei zelo yispalel. He should not daven. Why? Mishum shene'emar, because it is written, Hikon the cross of the Hecha Yisrael. Prepare yourself to meet your God, O Israel. Now I have to say, this is a very important pasuk in the book of Amos, you know, the prophet Amos. And of course, I mean, there he's talking to the people of Israel, and he says, you know, prepared, you're going to have to face God, O Israel. Okay? But our Chazal, our Chachomim, they apply it to in general. When you go to Daven Shmoneh Esrei, approach it with the fact you're actually coming face to face with the Rebbeinu Shelenu. And therefore, there are many authorities who say that therefore it means that you should be dressed up when you say Shmoneh Esrei. You should wear a tie, a jacket, and things like that.
Shorts,
I mean,
shorts,
right? Yeah, you shouldn't come around in kutzahazin, all right? Open shirts and things like that. Okay, I don't have to tell you that this is a big question. You know, in America, I don't have to tell you. You know, based upon also what was the custom in Europe, normally a person is expected to be dressed properly when he says Shmoneh Esrei. But first of all, we're living in an age where informal dress has become the style. Right? So not everybody wants to dress formally. They consider even informal dress as being presentable enough. And then, of course, in Eretz Israel, I don't have to tell you. They'll interrupt their work in the fields in order to come to Daven, and I say, Yasher Kocham. I mean, that God should bless them. I mean, these are people who are working to rebuild the land, and that they take time out to Daven. So even if they're davening in kutzahazin and open blouses, you know, and then no ties, no jackets, and no nothing, but nevertheless,
it's a mitzvah.
It's a mitzvah, right? And if you've been, you know, in any moshav or a kibbutz where, you know, that they have a shul where they come to daven, you appreciate that fact. The Omer Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmani, in another statement of Shmuel bar Nachmani, said, Omer Rabbi Yonasan, also the name Rabbi Yonasan, he says, my disiv, now he gives a taij to a verse that we have in the book of Koheles. Pasuk says over there, Shemor Rag Lecho, Kasher Tedech Lebeis Olehim. It continues, as we'll see. It goes, you know, phrase by phrase within the Pasuk and Titus. The first part of the Pasuk says, guard your foot, literally, when you go to the house of God. So, what did Rabbi Yonason say? He said, Shemor Atzbecho, Shelo Techto. He says, you know, watch your foot. In other words, watch out. Be in the proper state when you go to the house of God. That's the first thing that he's saying. And he says, Shaloi Tepto, so that you will not commit a sin. Okay? In other words, the first thing, bear in mind that when you daven, when you go to face God, when you go to a shul, it should be an incentive to you, first of all, what? Not to sin. Okay? Shaloi Tepto. That's the first thing. And secondly, v'yim techto, and if you do sin, then hove korban leponai, then in that case, bring a korban unto me. Okay? Now the verse continues, v'korov lishmoa divrei chachamim, and also, literally, be near or ready yourself to listen to the words of the wise. Omarovo, so Rava says, "Habei korov lishma divrei chachamim." This parts of mean she'im chotim. Take a look at the chachamim. What do they do? She'im chotim. If they sin, mevi'im korban. They bring a korban. They owe him teshuva, and also they do teshuva. In other words, it isn't enough for them to simply bring a korban, but at the same time they also have to do teshuva. That's what the chachamim do. Mitteis laksilim zevach, rather than the way the fools give their sacrifice. You know, that's the continuation of what it says. Al tehi katsilim shechotim mevi'im korban. It says, don't be like the fools who sin and they bring a korban. They ain't noisim tshuva, but they do not do tshuva. In other words, they're only doing mechanical things. In other words, they come and they bring a sacrifice, but there is no spirit behind the sacrifice. The sacrifice has not given them the incentive to change their way of life and to do tshuva, you see. Ki einam yodim lasa yisra'an. The pasuk continues, because they do not know how to do evil. So he says, what do you mean they don't know how to do evil? Ihochi says, tzadikim ninu. Hey, they're tzadikim if they don't know how to do what's wrong.
That's right.
All that they can do is right. So that's not what it means, but rather, what does it mean? El al tehikak silim, he says, don't be like the fool, shechotim and viim korban, you know, who sin and they bring a korban, v'yeinum yodim, and they don't know, im al ha-teva he-me-viim, im al ha-ro he-me-viim, and they don't know whether when they bring a korban, they're doing it for something good, or they're doing it for something which is evil. Let me explain to you what it means, okay? Why do we bring sacrifices? Well, the answer is we have different types of sacrifices that we bring. Okay? All right. For example, we have committed sin. This is al-hara. Okay? So, for the sins that we commit, we have different sacrifices that we have to bring. For example, if we do it bishkoga, in other words, we've committed, you know, a violation of something that the Torah says thou shalt not do, right? And we have violated that, but we've done it, you know, not purposely, but by accident we didn't know that we were doing wrong or something like that, right? Then in that particular case, what do we have to do? We have to bring a chatas, okay? Or there are certain specified sins in the Torah for which a person has to bring as his kapora, you know, as his atonement. He has to bring what we call an oshon, a trespass offering. That's the English translation for it, okay? We have also another type of a sin that we may or may not be sure of, and that's called oshon tolui, okay? But you're not sure, you're bringing it just to be on the safe side in case. But then if you find out that you really did the sin, then you have to bring a chatas. If not, then okay, so you brought a sin because you were even doubtful in your own mind. So this is what he means by al-hara'ah. But what about Alatova? What kind of sacrifices do we bring for good things? Well, like for example, Shlomim, peace offerings. Something good happens in our family, we want to celebrate. Or Toda, God has saved us, we were spared an accident, we crossed the ocean safely, we got out of jail. Right, we were very sick, and we recovered from a serious illness, you understand? Those very things for which we bench Goimel. But in the olden times, when the Beis HaMikdash was in existence, they also would bring a Korban Todo for that. Okay? A Thanksgiving offering. So, that's what he means by Al HaTova. David?
All right. Well, my question herein is that even a fool would be able to know the difference between bringing a Korban Hatah or a Korban Todah. I mean, this would be normal if you were
educated enough to realize that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
And other sins
yeah.
that you commit that you
right.
know you commit.
Yeah.
So are they referring to the different sacrifices that had to be made? That these people were not knowledgeable enough to know that if they brought a dog or whether it was for one or the other.
Okay. Possibly. But the way I understand it, it's the first distinction that I made. In other words, why are they bringing a sacrifice? If it is for something good in their life, fine. If it is because they've committed evil and they want to atone for it, fine. But if they're simply bringing a sacrifice, but they don't know for what reason they are bringing a sacrifice, then this is b'teis lak silim zevach. Then their sacrifice is the sacrifice of fools. Okay? So we should know. And of course, again, I stress that and if we have sin, so we should be like the Chachomim, that they do tshuva, and not be like the Ksilim, that they don't do tshuva. Mm-hmm. Because the sacrifice should lead to doing tshuva. Okay, let me just finish over here. That's all right. Well. yes. Okay. So Amar Abba Kodesh Baruch Hu. So the Rebbeinu Shel Olam said, "Bein Toiv L'Ra Einon Ma'abchinim." They don't know how to distinguish between good and evil. The Hei Mevim Korban L'Fonai, and they're bringing a korban before me. They should know what is right and what is wrong, and what the good things to bring korban, so on and so forth. All right. Rav Ashi Yitemer Rav Chanina Ba'Popo Amar. But here is a different interpretation that these authorities, some say this Rav Ashi and some say this Rav Chanina bar Papa. He says, you know what's the meaning of Shmor Raglecha? It says Shmor Nikavecha. In other words, be careful that you don't have have a bowel movement, which is the usual meaning of Nikavecha, or others suggest that also applies. Don't urinate, okay? B'shor shatol meid b'tzvila l'fonai, at the time when you stand in Shmon Esser before me. But I have to say that more likely the first interpretation I gave you is more correct. Why? Because we'll see what follows. However, not tonight. That'll save it next week.
Okay, so
next week in the Yitz Hashem, yeah. So we're in the middle of the page over
middle
here.
Middle page of...
Right, and we'll continue next week from the Rabbanu.
Okay.
Yeah, in the middle of the Chav Gimel Amud Aleph. Okay. The urination, defecation, etc., etc. I guess we can all use a vacation.
Good evening. Good evening. How do you do? Shalom Aleichem.
Okay, so we're on Chav Gimel Amud Aleph right now, and we shall continue from where we left off last week. All right.
45.
All right. The past week or two or so, we've been talking about the fact that, first of all, if you have a call of nature, then by all means do it before you start into davening. because there are really two basic reasons why. One of them is the fact that you have to have kavona. You know, you have to have be in the proper frame of mind when you daven. And if your mind is on the fact that you have an urgent call, you know, so it's a little difficult to concentrate.
Distracting.
Okay? Very distracting. Okay. And of course, in conjunction with that, we learned that the question is, this is what we discussed the other week, okay, what happens if a person was caught short right in the middle of dawn? Okay? So, does he have to begin all over again or not? And we saw that in general the question is based upon, first of all, how long did he interrupt, and this would apply not just to the question, you know, of having to be interrupted because of the fact that he has a call of nature, but also in general something suddenly you know, breaks into whatever it may be, distracts him and so on. Whether let's say he was trying to daven for Neuschwanstein and suddenly he got stuck someplace, he couldn't remember what it was. But at any rate, where do you go back to? Do you have to go back to the very beginning of the Shemoneh Esrei, or do you go back to the beginning of the bracha where you were stuck? And one opinion is it depends on the amount of time. If it's only for very short amount of time, then it's enough to go back to the bracha where you started from. Okay, let's say you're in the middle of Baruch Aleinu or something like that, so you go back to Baruch Aleinu. If on the other hand it is already a longer amount of time, then in that particular case we saw that in that case you go back to the beginning of the Shemoneh Esrei and do it all over again. And so this is one of the halachas that we learned from the discussion. And then of course I mentioned that there were two basic reasons that the Gemara brings. Basic reason number two, why should a person, you know, take care of his the call of nature before he goes to daven, besides the fact, you know, that it's a question of kavana. But as we learned, there's another reason too, and that is that when you daven Shemoneh Esrei, you should be in a frame of mind that you're facing the Ribbono Shel Olam. And the quotation that they bring is from the book of Amos, where it's written, Hikon Nekras Elechach Yisrael, prepare yourself to face your God, O Israel. So that when we say Shemoneh Esrei, we really have to be in such a condition that we're not ashamed to face God. And this is why many people, for example, feel that if you're not dressed up with a jacket and a tie and things like that and so on, you know, that it's not proper to daven that way. Of course, we are living in an age where the standards of dress are much more relaxed than that, and of course partly it was due to the fact that in Eretz Israel, as we saw, you know, there were people who daven in short sleeves, no tie, no jacket. And nevertheless, are we going to say that their prayer is an abomination to the Lord because of the fact that they're dressed that way? So as a result, as I said, on the contrary, we have to admire people who put in a very difficult day's work, working out in the fields, doing whatever that they're doing over there, and at the same time they take time out in order to daven a shacharis, a mincha, a maariv, try to find time to do a little bit learning and things like that and so on and so forth. So the dress has become acceptable. So much so, of course, in Eretz Yisrael, you know, that even diplomats these days, or at least they used to run around also in their shirt sleeves. This was the typical dress.
That's the accepted code of dress there.
Right.
The accepted code of dress here is with a jacket
but
and
here,
a tie.
Exactly. All right. So, you know, that already is a problem. But nevertheless, there were days this summer when even I didn't wear a jacket. It was simply impossible. I mean, when you're struggling with 90 to 100 degree heat and the chapel sometimes is not as air conditioned as it should be, as we remember from our experience. So in that case, I mean, it would be permissible to do it. And but again, the basic thing is that what kind of frame of mind should we have when we daven? And as we see, it should be a frame of mind wherein we feel that we are really face to face with the Rabbeinu Shalom, so that we can pour out our heart unto him, and we treat him the Yiro, you know, with awe, with the feeling of Kedusha, of holiness, and so on. And this is what we're trying to instill. So, we continue now with this general theme. Of course, you remember also we spoke about what happens if you're out in the field. You stop to say Shemoneh Esrei, and all of a sudden you discover that as you are about to begin davening, lo and behold, I mean, you're standing right near some excrement that's been up over there. So what do you have to do? So in that case, we saw you have to distance yourself at least Dalet Amos, at least it would be 6 to 7 feet away from it, so they're not facing it and so on, and then you know you should daven. Why? Because again, the place wherein you daven should be a place where you can feel a sense of Kedusha. It's as simple as all that. You have to feel that you're davening in a place which is clean and which lends itself, you see, to the recital of the Shemoneh Esrei, which after all represents, as we would say, Techino. You're supplicating God. You're praying unto him that he should grant your requests. You pray to him, you know, for good health, and you pray to him for panosa. That's the basic idea of Borech Aleinu, incidentally, is panosa, you know, that to be able to make a living and so on. So that you have to be in a place which is reasonably clean in order to be able to do it. And then, of course, another thing that we learned last week is that if you can actually hold yourself in for the distance, you know, that would take to walk a parsa, which would be, let's say, about, if you can hold it in for 20 minutes, a half hour, or something like that, then in that case you don't have to repeat the prayers because, you know, you will yotze with the davening. But again, it was basically in order to make sure that you would be in the proper frame of mind and the proper state of, shall we say, cleanliness in order to be able to face God in prayer. Now, tonight we continue, and we start first of all with the theme of Beis Kisei. What is a Beis HaKisei? I'm sure this is one of the words that we learned way, way back in Hebrew school. When you say, you know, Moreh, can I go to the Beis HaKisei, right? Today in Israel, by the way, they prefer to say, instead of Beis HaKisei, they prefer to use the expression, either Nochiyot, which means literally, or Sherutin, okay, correct. Or Bet Shibush, I mean, there's also, Bet Shibush.
What does it mean?
They are all different terms and used for a bathroom, okay?
Nochiyot means convenience.
Right, Nochiyot is convenience.
Sherutin means services,
right?
Beishmas would be the house of usage,
right? Place where you have to do what you have to do. You see.
Sounds good.
But these are all expressions that they prefer to use instead of Beis Kisei.
Like we say outhouse.
Right.
They're different names.
Correct. Now, Sam, it so happens, you see, that what was the Beis HaKisei in those days? They didn't have indoor Beis Kiseis with plumbing or anything like that. So let's talk an outhouse, okay? So, as we'll see right now, you know, that they would build these places. It was out in the field. This was the normal place where they would build it. And this was what the Gemara is going to call a Beis Kisei Kavua. In other words, a place which has been set aside to be used as a Beis HaKisei, an outhouse, okay? All right, so we continue now from the middle of the page over there where it says Tonu Rabbanan, okay? Mm-hmm. Opposite it, you'll see there's a quotation from Shabbat, so there's a little star over there, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Tonu
Rabbanan. All right, so now we quote a Gemara which actually has its place of origin in the Gemara Shabbos. It says, HaNichdos LeBeis HaKisei, if a person enters the Beis HaKisei, then cholets tefilov berachok dalet amos benichnas. Then he has to take off his tefillin a distance of dalet amos, in other words, again, six, seven feet or so, before he actually goes into the Beis HaKisei, and then he can enter the Beis HaKisei. So we see from this already that if a person has to go, then in that